Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is first-time co-host Deborah Stanish.
I'm so excited to be here. I love the podcast. I love the topics. This is just, it's exciting to go back and look at things that you may have a rocky or not so rocky relationship with.
Can you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and where they might have heard you?
Sure. I am the moderator of Verity Podcast, which is which I co-host along with five additional amazing women. I think we're in our 12th year now. And I also jump around a bit on some of the Incomparable podcasts. I've done a lot of the game shows. I've done some smooch episodes, just recorded a Turns Out. So, you know, where things, when I'm available and things are interesting, I like to jump on and sort of be very ineffectual in a lot of games, but I tend to win the random pursuit a lot, much to my chagrin, mostly because I get very easy questions.
So this time we are doing Eudora Welty's 1941 short story, The Why I Live at the P.O., probably her most anthologized story. What is your history with this story? Is this the first time you've read it, or have you read it several times, or...?
This is actually the second time I've read it, because I did read her short story, the collection that came out, I believe, in what was it, 1941. And this was actually her first collection of short stories, and A Curtain of Green. And I remember picking that up and reading it when I was going on my Eudora Welty journey. She's not an author I read in school. I graduated in the early 80s, so it was still very much, if you read a woman in high school, when I was in high school, even in honors English, it was, you know, Jane Austen, Mary Shelley, maybe some Emily Dickinson, Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Like, it was not a particularly... It was a lot of dead white men. So when I was in college, I took a very interesting literature course and sort of really touched on a lot of the female authors that I had not had a chance to read when I was earlier. And it just really opened my eyes and how some writers tend to get a lot of accolades, and some writers, even though they've won the prizes, they've won the awards, they don't still hold that same standing when you think about sort of our conventional literature that's taught in schools. And Eudora Welty was one of those writers. So, of course, I picked up, you know, in her own words, her autobiography. It's not really an autobiography. It's a collection of vignette stories that she told during a Harvard lecture series. And that was really interesting. And I sort of dove into, just dipped in and out of some of her work over the years. And this story I first read in that collection. And again, we talked a little bit before we started recording of it. It just seems like this little simple snippet of life, very colorful, very Southern, which she's known for. But when you read it, there's a lot of complexity to it. There's a lot built into this story. And I reread it for this podcast. When you asked if anybody's interested in doing this, I'm like, I will always talk about Eudora Welty because I find her to be a fascinating individual. So I reread it and found it just as puzzling, just as complex as I did the first time. So I'm excited to talk about it.
As for me, I did not read Eudora Welty until I was in grad school. I did go to a fairly hippy-dippy college, so we read a variety of writers. I am aware that in the North, at least, Southern authors tended to be less taught. You had Faulkner, you had people like, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, that people don't think of as Southern writers. When I got to grad school, I had a class where I was taught Flannery O'Connor first, and then Eudora Welty. And because of the order in which I read them, I always assumed that Flannery O'Connor was the earlier writer, but she actually comes after Eudora Welty. She came up in the Work Progress Administration of the 1930s, and she came up as a reporter working in the Deep South. She was from Mississippi. She'd gone to school in various places, including Wisconsin, but and she tried for a while to make it as a copywriter in New York City, but then the Great Depression happened, and she came back to Mississippi. And for the WPA, she did like what a lot of WPA projects were at the time. We were going around and recording local culture. And so she wrote from firsthand accounts. She is often considered a Southern Gothic writer, but she did not like that term. She did not want to be lumped in with the Southern Gothics. I find that interesting because Southern Gothic writing, to me, always feel difficult to me as a Northerner to discuss it because it seems so self-critical, you know, and so like this is someone else's story and it's so much someone else's story that I don't want to, I have to be very careful about the way I approach it. And while Welty may not want to consider herself a Southern Gothic writer, a lot of her stories are about extreme characters, are about mm-hmm. very broadly drawn caricatures of people. In that way, they remind me a bit of like Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson, or Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas. They're very specifically about a specific place, but the way they do that is by presenting characters that are so broad, they would be stereotypes, except that they're so crazy, they aren't stereotypes. Where are you from? What is your...
I'm from the Mid-Atlantic. I grew up in Delaware. I currently live outside of Philadelphia. So I've always lived in this region. And I always did as well sort of clump her in that Southern Gothic thing. But she's so much more than that. And I think when you look at her, even the perception that we have of her, she's very a very small life. Do you know what I mean? She grew up in a very small town. She lived there for the most of her life, but she was pretty well traveled. I mean, she won 2 Guggenheim fellowships, and actually the second one allowed her to travel, and she did some teaching in England at the universities there. But she has this reputation sort of like almost like an Emily Dickinson kind of thing of a very small world. But I think because she had so closely observed people around her, she was able to I think caricature is kind of not exactly the term that you want to use, but it's painting archetypes, I guess, almost of what we think of as Southernness, but being able to tell a larger story by employing those archetypes of what she has observed in her daily life and in what she has done in this small town in Mississippi. But it's difficult to sort of place her because her writing, even though it paints with those very broad strokes, it's very sophisticated, and the language is it just seeps into you, and you find yourself reading something that seems very simplistic and something that's very much a caricature, and start picking that apart a little bit, and it is incredibly sophisticated. So it's almost this dichotomy of what she's trying to say in the way she's trying to say it. And I just find that fascinating about her. And she had strong opinions about what people were to think about her. She really did not want a biography written about her. She kept, you know, extensive correspondences with people even as she got older. And she was very protective of her reputation and what her legacy was going to be. I was actually reading a really, really interesting biography of her, of a woman who became friends, went down and did some research. And I can pull that up because I don't have the name at the tip of my tongue before we get done recording. And the things that we think about Eudora Welty just as this person of this type. I mean, she really was a lot more than that. And she was much broader than that. And I think that gets lost when we try to kind of clump her into this category of Southern writers. So I'd love to see a Eudora Welty resurgence and to see more examination of her works, because I think she really deserves that.
Well, as an aside there, you remind me that I need to do an Emily Dickinson episode. So I'll put that down on my notes. Why I Live at the P.O. is a very short story. And it is, in some ways, it feels at first like a character study of this main character. who is just called Sister. You know, if you ever see a Tennessee Williams play and you think people don't actually have these names, they don't actually call it Big Daddy or whatever. These characters all here are that we have the narrator Sister, we have her sister Stella Rondo, we have Papa Daddy, Uncle Rondo, Shirley T, and I find myself kind of wondering, is this the real life or is this just fantasy? It's a story of how Sister is living in very close quarters. I wouldn't call it squalor, but I would call it very modest living, along with her parents, when her sister suddenly shows back up at the house after becoming estranged from Stella Rondo, the sister being estranged from her husband, Mr. Whitaker, who was previously a boyfriend to Sister. So right from the beginning, we have this crazy quilt of interrelated family relationships, close ties, but also a lot of resentment and anger. It everything feels sort of like so over the top in such a very short amount of space. It's a very bright story, if you know what I mean. Like the everyone's very funny, and it's full of noise, and it's full of crazy little family incidents.
You know, it's really interesting to me, you're talking about the crazy names, of how those names are assigned. So everyone has a first name except for Papa Daddy, Sister, and Mama, which I find to be really fascinating, because these are sort of the backbones of the family. These are the Uncle Rondo has PTSD, or whatever you would like to call it, from World War I, with the battle fatigue, I think they were calling it back in the day. We have Stella Rondo, who is clearly the adversary in this, her adopted daughter. I'm air quoting that. But we have Mama and Sister and Papa Daddy, who are sort of, the tent poles of this family. The Sister is the one who works at the PO. She got the job through Papa Daddy, who is the patriarch. And then Mama is the stereotype of Mama. So, the choices were deliberate, I think, in how we are titling these. Who gets a name and who gets a title? Who gets a role as opposed to a proper name? And it seems like the more eccentric you are, the more likely you are to get to be allowed to be a person.
The conflicts in this story, there are several conflicts. One is the conflict that happens before the story starts, which is that Stella Rondo has stolen the affections of Mr. Whitaker, although we don't know exactly what the circumstances were, whether Sister really was going to be with Mr. Whitaker for any length of time or not. But there is some lingering resentment there. She's left Mr. Whitaker for reasons untold. She's got this child in hand that she claims is adopted. She's not fooling Sister about that. Sister can see the family resemblance, but it's unclear whether this is Mr. Whitaker's kid or more likely someone else's kid. There's some reason that she's leaving Mr. Whitaker that's not being told. So there's those kinds of conflicts seem to be the kind of conflicts that you see in a lot of family dramas. But then the other conflicts are the fact that Stella Rondo poisons the well between Papa Daddy and Sister by claiming that Sister says that Papa Daddy should get a shave. And Papa Daddy is incensed because he's been growing his beard now for many, many years. And he refuses to touch it, and he retires to the hammock outside in a huff.
I'm sorry. It's interesting. We're talking about the, Stella Rondo's baby, Shirley T, who's a toddler at this point. And I think they make it very clear when she comes back that this child is adopted, because the implication being, if it wasn't adopted, it was a child that was was conceived prior to marriage to Mr. Whitaker. Mm-hmm. And that is, it is a social lie that everyone is buying into, especially mama. Yes, this baby is adopted. Of course, this baby is adopted. It's one of those things that, you know, it would not do in the family to have a to have an illegitimate child or a child conceived out of wedlock. Because even though the circumstances, like you said, it wasn't squalor, but it's very close. They have a very this story has a claustrophobic feel at times. You know, they have two servants who are let go for the day. So and Papa Daddy is clearly someone of importance in the community, as they talk about later, people not willing to get on the bad side of Papa Daddy. So it is a family that has some sort of status, whatever that status may be in the community. So these little lies that they're telling each other, and even, you know, talking about Uncle Rondo and the excusing him. Of course, what did Julia Sugarbaker say in Designing Women? Like, we don't talk about, we don't hide our crazy in the attic. We invite it down to the living room and put it in the corner. So the idea of these social niceties that must be maintained, and sister's just not having it. She is just cutting through the crap and saying, this looks like Mr. Whitaker. It looks like Papa Daddy. Like, this child is clearly of our bloodline.
Uncle Rondo comes by apparently every 4th of July. This is set on the 4th of July, and takes his unspecified medicine, whatever that is. He takes a lot of it and spends the day high or unconscious. And when we first see him, he is wearing Stella Rondo's flesh-colored kimono. The rest of the family doesn't seem particularly scandalized by the fact that Uncle Rondo is wearing Stella Rondo's trousseau, as she keeps referring to it. What they argue about is whether or not he looks any good in it. And there's the line where sister uses a chance to take a dig at Stella Rondo by saying, well, he looks as good as anybody could look at that.
I think it's interesting that we have, you know, there's a couple different interpretations of sister. Like, is she the unreliable narrator in this story? Are we only seeing it through her perspective? Clearly, we are meant to sympathize with sister. But, you know, she gets her own in. She gets some good digs, even as she's trying to defend herself, as Stella Rondo works really hard to turn the rest of the family against her.
It's interesting what you say about the unreliable narrator. You know, you often read these first-person narratives, and we're very used to that as readers, not really questioning what the occasion is for the main character to be telling you their story. You know, it could just be something that's going through their head. It could be something they're writing down as a journal. We don't care. We're just reading the story. But the story ends in an interesting way, in the very last section where she says, and that's the last I've laid my eyes on any of the family, or my family laid eyes on me for 5 solid days and nights. And it's such a sudden placing this in a moment of time. Now the narrator is saying, it's been exactly 5 days since the events that I've recounted. And her tone shifts to saying, well, I'm sure Stella is saying things about me, but, you know, but I'm sure that's none of my business. I'm sure, you know, you understand the truth. And if she showed up now and tried to say she was sorry, I wouldn't give her the time of day. So that last moment suddenly recontextualizes the entire story in this moment of sister explaining the story to a person, to someone outside of the family, and trying to make the best case for herself that she can. And I think this is one of those brilliant things that I love when stories do it, where suddenly the point of view shifts and it causes us to think differently about the entire story. This is very common in Alice Munro, who just recently died, who's probably my favorite author. And it also happened in another one of Eudora Welty's stories that I'm very fond of, called Old Mr. Marble Hall, in which the narrator, the third person narrator, suddenly passes judgment on everything that has happened, and it causes you to rethink everything. Does that make sense, or I'm just babbling on here?
You know, it's really interesting that you talk about that shift in perspective, because at the very beginning of the story, if you notice, the one thing that turned, that Stella Ronda used to turn Mr. Whittaker against Sister, was saying that she was one-sided. And you're like, what does that mean? What does one-sided, how could we interpret that? But this whole story is one-sided. We are getting one side of the story from Sister. And it's not until the end that we get that idea that, okay, she's explaining the events. Of course she is going to make herself be the hero of her own story. So I think it's really interesting that that's right in like the first or second paragraph that she's using that term one-sided. And of course, Sister's like, I am absolutely not one-sided. Like, that was just so wrong. I can't believe Mr. Whittaker fell for that. But Eudora put that right in the beginning of the story and led us right down the path.
What do you think? Are your sympathies ultimately with Sister?
You know, it's really, you were made to believe that Sister is very wrongly put upon. And I'm just kind of thinking about this in today's context of how is this story, if you were reading the story today, year of our Lord 2024, in English class, everybody would be absolutely on the side of Sister. Here she is in a situation where the servants have been let go for the day. And I think we do need to acknowledge that there are some very racial undertones with that part of it. It's very much a story of its time. And here she is doing the work of those servants while also being the postmistress. She has a job outside of the home. And so she is in charge of sort of that. She has been left in charge of doing the servants' work this day. And she talks about standing at the stove and trying to, you know, make two chickens feed five people now, plus this unexpected child that showed up. And you just feel like here there's a woman doing all of the emotional and physical labor for a family. And the sister comes waltzing in, just stirring up trouble. And there's very much, if this woman was on TikTok today, everybody would be in the comments supporting her. Let's put it that way, because the story is very much, I am doing all of this. And here comes somebody who absolutely has made my life miserable and continues to do so. But I also think there's some sympathy, should be some sympathy for Stella Rondo, because we don't actually understand what has happened to her. And she says at one point, Mr. Whittaker obviously has left you. That's why you're back. So there's this undercurrent of kind of cruelty also in her comments. Stella Rondo's coming off as very immature, sort of reverting back to those childhood roles that they had, and being, you know, the annoying little sister who was a bit spoiled, who got everything she wanted, and Sister feeling very resentful for that. But I think Sister's getting her own in this. As I said earlier, she makes some comments, she makes some digs that she is not trying to placate the situation at all. She's not trying to be understanding of the situation at all. But communication is incredibly important through line through this whole story, because the communication is terrible. Papa Daddy immediately assumes that, yes, Sister wants him to cut his beard, even though that came out of absolutely nowhere, takes that completely to heart. Everybody is saying and believing what is the first thing that comes out of everybody's mouth. And nobody is trying to have conversations, realistic conversations on what's happening. So it's like there's a surface of what is happening and what people are saying to each other and what's really going on under that surface. So it is, while it's still this claustrophobic atmosphere, it's also one where they are very, it's a family that is very used to not communicating deeply on anything and just holding up this, whether it's appearances or whether the social niceties or whether it's even the family structure. And Sister seems to be the only one who is willing to sort of poke holes in this and is willing to want to try to expose this truth and explain to people. But even she at the end is just, whatever, believe what you want to believe. I'm out of here. So, I think there's a couple different ways to read it. And I think it depends on what day of the week you're reading it. Honestly, there's days I think you could be very much on Sister side, and some days you could be thinking, I think there's more to this story.
I really, really liked something you said about the way that when Stella Rondo comes back, she's falling back into old familial patterns, because in some ways this story is about what family does for you and the way that also that family traps you. It's about, you know, with the exit of Stella Rondo, sister finds her position in the family more elevated. She's taking on this role outside the house. And now with the return of Stella Rondo, all of these family roles are being regressed to. And those family roles are keeping everyone stuck in a very specific place. That's another thing that I would say is a characteristic of a lot of Southern Gothic writing, is it's writing about people who find themselves unable to move forward in some way. In the traditional Southern Gothic, that means like a Faulkner story where people are stuck in pre-Civil War history and they can't escape that. They can't escape the legacy of their what their families were pre-Civil War. But in this case, it's not that. It's families. This family is unable to move on. And at the end of the story, sister moves on insofar as she moves to the PO, where she's got this job, which is pretty much a sinecure. There's not really much to it. It's a tiny little town. There's almost no mail coming in. And there's a funny little fight where, Mammy says that she's not going to come to the PO. And
right, they're never mailing anything ever again.
Apparently, the story that I've seen cited many places that Welty wrote this after seeing a photograph of a woman doing ironing in the mm-hmm. back of a post office. And that's sort of the juxtaposition of this highly domestic thing in what's supposed to be a governmental office. I really like what you say about family, though, because this does, in the end, this is a story about a very tight-knit family. Whether or not at the moment they are not on speaking terms with each other, I feel like, you know, you catch up with them in another 5 years and they'll still be up to the same nonsense.
Absolutely. I mean, there's even the moment where Mama says, you know, just forget all that and come and play cards, whatever the card game was. And she's like, no, I'm really going this time. Like, I've had it. And the pettiness of sister and all the things that she takes out of the house is just, it's delightful. She takes the tax like out of the one of the calendars, and then she takes the tax or something. She goes, I bought the tax. I'm taking the tax. They will look very good at the post office. And she takes the motor out of the sewing machine and like all the things that I paid for, the preserves that she made out of the cupboard. So there's definitely, you kind of feel like this isn't the first time there's been some big drama, because everybody's just taking it so matter-of-factly. And again, sister is not all that kind, because she turns to Stella Rondo at that moment and says, well, if nobody's going to use the post office, how are you going to know when Mr. Whitaker wants you back? And she just completely loses it at that point. And Stella Rondo just like breaks down and cries. And, you know, she's going through it, let's face it. But I can definitely see that does everybody remember that time that sister moved to the PO for 5 days and took all the tacks out of the wall? Like this becoming a family story of the time Stella Rondo came back with Shirley T. So it is a very close-knit family. They're so accepting of Uncle Rondo. They don't even talk about Uncle Rondo. Like you said, he's in the kimono. It's clear. She says at one point when he's leaving, he says, do you want my cot? And sister just says, well, that would be very nice if you had one. And then she notes that he's in France at the moment. And so just this acknowledgement of, you know, what Uncle Rondo's going through, and it's just a matter of life. It's just what he's doing, even though, you know, he wakes her up in the 6:30 in the morning by throwing a full string of firecrackers in her room to get back at her. It's like, well, don't you worry about that. It's just Uncle Rondo. Like, why are you so upset? So I think it's a family that is both very accepting of the deficiencies of each other, but also at the same time being testy and not willing to look at the truth behind things, rather just the surface of what they need to do to communicate as a family, to keep those appearances and But there's still some affection there. There really is. I mean, she talks about, sister does have the resentment because she does mention at one point, you know, if she showed up with a child, an adopted child at home, you know, would her reception be the same? And it most certainly would not. Mom is like, absolutely, it would be. Like, what are you talking about? And so it's really interesting to listen to them talk to each other, because whether it's affection or just habit, they definitely are close.
Even though the title is Why I Live at the PO, almost the entirety of the story takes place within the walls of their home. And the outs, to the extent that there is any there are any characters that are not the family, they are the servants who, as you mentioned, are addressed using epithets, and it's a little rough. And in fact, you know, when she moves out to the PO, she basically conscripts this poor little black girl to take all her stuff in a wagon for her. There's no expectations of payment or
but Uncle Rondo pays her.
I think
it's Uncle Rondo. It's either Papa Daddy or Uncle Rondo, like, gives her money for doing
okay,
that.
Okay, well, then I retract my thing. Oh, right. But she threw her a nickel.
Right. I mean, it wasn't a lot.
Is this a case where in 1941 a nickel was worth $65 to, I don't know.
But it was nine loads for a nickel. It was nine loads of that wagon. So it was a bargain.
At the end of the story, when we finally get sister's voice trying to make the case for why this wasn't her fault and why she's actually glad to be living at the post office and why she's done this time, she's done with the family for good, that's the moment where you would kind of move out into the town around her. And you get the feeling that this is a quintessential small town that knows everyone else's business and that has strong opinions about everyone else. And so, you know, sister is now leaving that layer of the onion for the layer of community in the town. But she's very wary about that too, because she knows that she has to get the town on her side or her life will just be as miserable outside as in. I don't know where I'm going with this, except that a lot of stories like this spend a lot of more time talking about what the community around thinks or doesn't think. We're left guessing.
It's a very isolating story when you think about it. But, you know, it is the smallest of small towns, because she mentions on several occasions that it's the second smallest post office in all of Mississippi. And I mean, like I said, sister's not taking any stuff. And she does talk about, you know, there's some people that are going to take Stella Rondo's side, and there's some people that are going to take her side just because they don't want to get on the wrong side of Papa Daddy, and there's some people that are on her side. But what I mean the story is isolating is that here's sister feeling very isolated by her family, by Stella Rondo turning them against her one by one, and that she moves out into a place where she is also isolated. She's in this post office by herself. You don't talk about any facilities like a kitchen or an outhouse or anything, but she's making do. She's planting butter beans at the front. It makes it sound like she's very established there. She has moved out. She has made a life. She's been there for 5 days. And I think that's the part that catches you. It's like it makes it seem like it was this whole big blow up. I have my independence. I'm now living it. Why I live at the PO. Like, ma'am, you've lived there for 5 days. That's like vacation. That is not a life change. But she's taken herself from a situation where she feels like she's alone, there's nobody on her side, to a situation where she is actually alone. So is that a good thing, where, you know, you see this movement right now of women saying, you know, I'm better off without my husband because he just added more. He took more from my life than he added to my life. Is it that kind of a situation, or is it just a really good temper tantrum that she just feels like she needs to make her case? You don't really know. It's not really clear. I think that part of the story is really open to interpretation, however you want it, whatever way you want this to go. But they really do. I think Adora makes such a really good case of making this feel like it's such a stifling situation. She feels, sister feels like she's, you know, sort of battling against all these people, and not, doesn't matter what she says, Stella Ronda is twisting it. And then you just even had the metaphor of the house being completely closed with all the windows closed. Mississippi in July, like, I can't imagine the heat and how stifling that was. But like you said, like, there's, with the exception of, you know, Papa Daddy going out in the hammock, everything happens within this house. Like, all of the action happens within the house. And it makes you feel hot and stuffy and wanting escape as well, I think, as you're reading this.
This is my favorite kind of story. It makes me laugh, and then it makes me uncomfortable. And then I'm not sure ultimately what the stakes are. Was this sort of a Shaggy Dog story, like a Mark Twain story, that in the end, the humor is the fact that nothing really matters in what you've just been told? Or is it desperately important about what is this extremely bleak look into some very stifled lives? I don't know. I don't know. You know, as you said, you know, ask you how you feel on another day about the story. I don't know whether I would consider this to be primarily a comedy, whether I consider it to be some sort of a family drama, whether I think that it is an accurate portrayal of a certain kind of person in the South, or whether I think it's not, it's incidental that it's set in the South. I don't know. It's a very strange story.
And it's a very Adora Welty story, I think, because even when she was trying to do journalism and she was writing for several local papers, she always had this sense of irreverence. Even when reporting something, you know, something serious, she couldn't help but sort of slide a bit of comedy in there and realize that I could never be a straight journalist. I just can't do it. This is not my type of writing. But this medium allows her to talk about, and again, you don't know, is she talking about something that's really serious, a serious family dynamic issue, a dysfunctional family? And is the humor just there because life is filled with laughter and tears? That's very realistic. Or is she trying to tell a message through humor? Like, it just seems like a very Adora Welty story to me, when she was, particularly her early years. And I wonder sometimes whether that's maybe why she hasn't, in my opinion, it doesn't feel like she's stuck in the classic, you know, this is, even though this particular story is well taught, like, we don't have more Adora Welty in the general population of education these days. Is, do writers who lean on humor, with the exception of Mark Twain, just don't get the same level of respect as, say, you know, a Hemingway or a Faulkner, because her stories are laced with this, a little bit of uncomfortable humor a lot of the times. And I think it's an effective storytelling technique, because it does draw you in and it makes you think. But if you're just reading it, you know, you just whip through this story the first time, and it does seem like an amusing anecdote about, you know, a bunch of crazy Southern people and their wackadoodle family. But like I said, you know, when you start picking it apart, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. When you brought up Emily Dickinson earlier in the story, in this podcast, it makes me think that, you know, Dickinson occupies a similar position, although I think she's a little bit more, she's definitely more part of the canon, in that you have, at the time that Dickinson was writing, you had Walt Whitman, who was the epitome of masculine assertiveness. Like, I'm going to write this muscular poetry. It's going to be universal. You are going to marvel at the technique of it all. And at the exact same time, you had Dickinson writing these sharp little, brittle little interior verses that are so crystalline, and they're not there to try to impress you with their virtuosity. They're there to impress you with the incredible intelligence of the person writing them. And similarly, Welty, you know, she's writing at exactly the same time that Faulkner's writing. She's writing at exactly the same time that Hemingway is writing. She's that mid-century modernist writer. But she's not there to try to she's not out there trying to trumpet herself as like, oh, look at me, the heroic voice of my time. Even someone like Fitzgerald, she's writing these short little interior stories that are very incisive and funny and strange. And maybe it's the way that she writes them that is keeping her from being better known, or maybe, just maybe, it's because she's a woman.
You know, it could be, because a lot of, you know, a lot of women's literature gets sort of shunted aside as, you know, women's stories, and men's stories are universal stories. And I think that's a shame, because I think particularly the story talking about a dysfunctional family is a very universal experience. But yet, because it's written by a woman, has two women at the center of the story, you know, is that, and this story is not a particularly good example of that, because she said this is one of her better known stories. You just have to wonder if something is classified as frivolous because it has humor, because it's by a woman, it's not as serious, it's not taken as seriously. I mean, that's a broad stroke to paint literature with, but historically you look at science fiction and women science fiction writers of the 60s and 70s who were just fallen off the radar at the time, where you have, you know, your classic era male science fiction writers who are still heralded today. Excuse me, I'm tripping over my tongue. So, but yes, Emily Dickinson, it's interesting comparison of Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman, because they two completely different poetic styles. And yet, you know, we think of them as two, when we think of them, even without knowing their work, even without having read deeply of them, we have very distinct opinions of what they were and what they were trying to accomplish. So that's a good point.
Do you have anything you want to add at the end here?
I love the complexity of short stories like this. It's kind of one of my most favorite things to read. When you're reading something and it just comes off as, this is dessert, this is not the main course. But when you go back and you take another look at it, you're like, all right, there's still some meat hanging on these bones. And you go back and you look at it again. You're like, all right, we're looking at a banquet. There's so much to unpack here. The language is gorgeous. It is ridiculous at times. It leans into that Southern stereotype, but it just doesn't mask what is trying to happen. And the little twist at the end, like I said, when she tells the story about she's been there 5 days and five nights, and you just, it catches you a little bit, like, oh, okay, because you're set up to believe that this has been such a grand gesture. This has been a final, I'm done with my family. And it's not. And I think Welty handles that very deftly. And I enjoyed revisiting it. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thanks again to guest host Deborah Stanish. If you have an idea for a book, story, poem, or other reading to cover on a future episode, or a suggestion for a guest host, or if you'd simply like to say hi, you can write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. The Sophomore Lit theme song is by Malcolm Nygaard. This podcast is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. More funny, smart podcasts are available at theincomparable.com.
On this one particular book, one kid read the book in the whole class of like 32 kids, and he just basically cliff noted it, and the rest of them just BS their way through. I think that the instructor knew that, but he gave them points for creativity, and they all did pretty well because they were all pretty smart kids. But I said, could you at least pretend to read the book? You didn't, like, skim it, like, physically have it.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.